Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
Memorial Day, of course, we have a sober and serious reason for this particular holiday, of course, and that is to honor those who gave their lives so that we could be here. And that's a great chore in itself. But the way that we celebrate as Americans is often in the backyard with the grill going, because it is a symbol of being able to be together and sort of unbothered for a little while, you know, spend time with family and friends, think about those who have gone before and that we have lost. But at the same time, you may need to do that in the carport. you may not be out in the exact center of your backyard this weekend, because this year's Memorial Day is looking a little on the damp side. That's not to say we shouldn't go ahead and understand it and observe it, but that's it.
It just always work out that way.
For Jimbo. I'm not laughing at me. I'm tickled. Jimbo has purchased Tabasco pepper plants at Avery Island. I think he brought some pretty good ones at that point. Good on you. That's wonderful. That is really something or another. I'm happy to say that my one shishito plant is doing well, and the banana pepper has decided to show out. So I'm a very happy person with those. The hot peppers will be along a little bit later, I think. Today is, interestingly enough, a day when we think about those who have gone before. We also, in our own way, think about what we're doing in our gardens, and that is the subject of this. I believe that, you know, everything that we are able to do really does come about because we are a free nation, and if we can appreciate that, every day we'll be better people. But if we can appreciate it, particularly this weekend and on Monday, in thanking those folks who gave of themselves so tremendously and totally, and their families too, you know, it's you lose your life, but your family is also losing a lot at that point too. So dig harder, dig deeper, plant more, let's grow something. I'm happy to tell you that we are promoting the first glimpse in this world of the Fondren Bottle Tree Tour poster for this year. It's basically the same design. It's just recolored because that's how we decided back in the beginning of this thing to start. Rooted in art, blooming in Fondren, and this, of course, is FondrenGardenTour.com. It is on Saturday, June the 6th, and we will be interviewing those folks next weekend. But I wanted to go ahead and pop that out there since they sent it to me, because it's really beautiful. It's a lovely poster. It would make a great T-shirt. What do you think?
I think so.
They do a real good job with their T-shirts. No question about that. There are a lot of events going on. I would just tell you that it's a perfect time to be a human being, to be out in the world, to be experiencing, whether it's rain or shine, you know, we get a chance to get out there in our gardens. I have so much rain going on at the moment that my tomato plants have listed to one side slightly, you know, but they're still full of fruit, and every day I go out and prop them up a little bit more. So I felt like I was pretty good. The folks at the farmers market last weekend here in City Park in New Orleans told us that they would be bringing the first tomatoes next week. So I'm not very far behind the farmers. I always like to keep up. There's a few, of course, that have them because they have high tunnels and whatnot. But those of us who grow out in the wild are having a little bit slower time with all this rain. But that's okay. We'll be there. Oh, by the way, this is for you, Lance. Tomorrow is National Asparagus Day.
Nice.
So you have permission to not only eat all you want, but to force it on other people.
Yes. That's the best part of it, right?
That's the best part. You can just say, you have to eat this.
Yes,
today's asparagus day.
Hey, one question back on the tomatoes.
Yes.
I've had to pull a couple of mine, three or four that had the soft black spots. I've had about 30 of them growing,
mm-hmm.
So it's not the majority, obviously. But with all the rain, I haven't fertilized really or done anything. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just been on its own, the sun, mm-hmm. the rain, mm-hmm. been watering them as I should. Why am I getting those black, soft, kind of rotty spots on a few of them on the bottom side that I've had to just chunk them, you know? But
mm-hmm.
what is that, and why am I getting
Welcome to blight.
Yeah.
Particularly if it's on the lower leaves first.
No, it's the actual tomato,
the tomato itself.
The fruit itself.
Okay,
yes.
And it's the whole fruit or just on the bottom?
Well,
of it?
It'll be like the bottom, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that's blossom end rot, mm-hmm. And it happens on squash too, particularly in wet seasons. I'm hearing from folks that they're experiencing that. So that's all that is. You can still eat that tomato, but it means that there's been too much water one day and too little the next, and that's mm-hmm. really not, you can't control that.
Yeah,
so well.
It just happened
that's
in the last 2 days.
Yeah, that's why we keep them mulched, but it still sometimes can go ahead and get you, because it's just the roots can't work as well, and by the time you see it in that fruit, of course, it's been several weeks since it started to develop, and when the roots can't take up enough because either they're waterlogged or because they're dry or because it's too big a difference from one day to the next, sometimes that shocks the roots too, then you'll end up without any ability to translocate water and nutrients to something, and in this case, it is the bottom of the fruit because that's the first thing that's the farthest away from the plant is the bottom of the fruit. So that's why blossom end rot happens. It's at the bottom of the blossom. Looking at Gloriosa daisies, by the way, at supertalk.tv today. And if you don't know about those, I encourage you to get into them. They are just beautiful. And, of course, we're, as usual, touting our buddies at Coast of Maine Soil. She's Tara Fritz and that whole gang just do such a beautiful job of putting out products that are, well, better. They're just better than everybody else's. I'll just go ahead and say that. And that's part of what's so much fun. Popsicles. Okay, that's cute. I see that. Red, white, and blue. Okay, I like that. An interesting set of pictures today at SuperTalk.
Well, that's the Rocket Pop right there, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe it must. I didn't know the name of it, but I recognize it as a frozen treat in three colors.
So. Yeah, it's the All-American Rocket Pop from my childhood. It made your mouth turn purple. I think that was the end.
That was the whole point.
In color, yeah. You started red, white, and blue. Yeah,
that was the entire point. Think how many people they had to practice on before they could whip that out into the
desired
market.
Color you wanted.
Exactly. What's going to happen now? Will it change their teeth? Let's see what we can do. Yes, indeed, my friends. Memorial Day is celebrated much in the United States with cookouts and parades, of course, and observations, and a very beautiful, important day. But I got to tell you, this has been going on for a long, long time. In 2000, let's start at the most recent developments. In 2000, the law was passed at 3 p.m. It asks all Americans, 3 p.m. local time, whatever your local time is, to pause for a moment of silence, 1 minute, 60 seconds, to recognize why we're all here and why we're able to do this. And that, of course, is the service of our heroes. Their loss reverberates throughout our history, and I'm not gonna try to make you depressed about it, but I am gonna say it's important, and I want you to pay attention. Okay, one of the things that happened, of course, in the history of this event, is that it began after the Civil War, and over the years has been expanded to other conflicts, and of course to become a national holiday, but. There's always the stories about where did all this start, who decided to do this, and it does come in the same, it goes in the same tradition as the folks who, of course, put flags at veterans' grave sites, and the whole thing of the flags at Arlington. It's important, and it makes a difference in people's lives, and it makes a difference in our ability to understand what we're seeing, okay? It didn't become a national holiday until 1971. It fell on whatever day it fell, and then they of course organized it into a Monday, the last Monday in May. And no, I don't think that the charcoal people had anything to do with that, but it certainly has come to herald the beginning of summer in many places. One of the plants that I am interested in this week, I have to tell you, I am thrilled that lacecap hydrangea has decided to bloom. Lacecap is one of those things that if you don't know anything about history or crocheting or, I don't know, Irish lacecaps, you probably wonder why in the world that has that name. And of course, what we're talking about is the hydrangea that is not a big round ball. That's hydrangea macrophylla, but it's the standard of the species. This one is a little bit different. It has been, it's a type of hydrangea that really has a different way of putting itself together. The flowers on the inside are flat. The cluster itself is a flat cluster, and that gives you the opportunity to appreciate it because the flowers open on the edges of it, which is why it looks like a cap. The little tiny tight flowers in the center become what would be like your the top of your head, and then the other little flowers go around the edges, and they open because that's where the cap part is, the cap and then the lace that goes around the edges, okay? But lace caps were interesting. Lace caps were one of those things. I think about them in the same way as I think about a lot of other really fine, crafted, beautiful, handmade laces. They never benefited the person who made it as much as they benefited the person who bought it, because the person who bought it was generally speaking of an upper class or an upper crust person, because they were able to afford this handmade labor piece, and they were absolutely beautiful. So they wore them everywhere. But this became a huge thing in around 1850, in the Great Famine and all that sort of stuff. These became really important for people to make because they had to have some way to make a living. So as a result, the irony of the situation, while Ireland was starving to death, one of the ways they made money was by making these absolutely magnificent, beautiful lace caps. And the women who could make those, the laces and the crochet that it took to do that, did a little better than those who could not. So it's one of those things. It's about not only the entrepreneurship, but the absolute determination of human beings to find some way to make a living. That's what we do. And I'm happy that we do. The center has of a lace cap hydrangea has hundreds of tiny little flowers. They are fertile. But it's just a different thing. The outer part is actually more of a halo of open flowers. And when you look at them, they're the same. They're shaped just exactly like the individual flowers within that cluster of the giant head, blue, pink, purple, whichever color you have, but the round-headed or big leaf hydrangeas. Okay? They're all related. They're absolutely all related. I had to do some calculating this week. I was trying to move something from kilometers to miles, and it didn't make sense to me until I went back in my head and looked around a little bit and poked out and said, oh yeah, I remember. 8 kilometers is about 5 miles. Okay, so that's the one that I have hung on to all these years. It's actually 8.04 something, something, something. But it is about that amount, and that's what has helped me figure out the differences in case you need those. Let's see now. Nathan's weighing in this morning on the text line. I invite you to do that as well. Sure hope you will today. He's wishing all of us a great Memorial Day weekend. And yes, the rain is wonderful for the peppers, especially the banana peppers. Nathan's are taken off like mine are. The rain and 70-degree temperatures has them on steroids, but the tomatoes, watermelons, and cantaloupes are suffering. That's true. They're not able to take as much rain and thrive as peppers or really some other things. Squash and stuff does well too, as long as it's in a raised situation. But yeah, it's very difficult. It's going to require some fertilizing in between storms or in between storm systems maybe. And I think it's part of what you just feel like, well, why am I doing this? It's going to rain again tomorrow. The good news is that the plant will be able to take some of it in, and hopefully not all of it will wash away in 2 hours. That's why I say either in between the storms or in between the storm fronts. Either way can work for you. There are an awful lot of crazy, crazy things going on in this world of ours. You look at something and you say, well, back in the day, we used to buy a product. There's just some things that you would have thought were already done too, and that's one of them here. You would have thought, because they took Dursban off the market as a trade chemical for use in lawns and whatnot, you would have figured that was it. You know, well, it's not. Columbia University's Milman School of Public Health is letting us know that there is, unfortunately, long-term effects even to exposure back when, and so it's chloriparous. We've talked about it before. And it's one of the things that people have, Well, people thought about it and argued about it, but the science came through and showed that it was not as effective as it needed to be for the risks involved, which is generally speaking how something ends up being changed. It no longer becomes commercially appropriate to do because its risks are greater than its rewards. We make those decisions about things all the time. But it's still used in agriculture. It used to be used in a lot of things. It used to be in, you know, cockroach spray and that, all those kind of things, bug sprays and whatnot. But the changes that it puts on people who are exposed to it over the long term, even children who were just in the environment, is the reason why it has gotten more and more attention now. So they're working on that particular process. Clearly, it's one of those things that is the reason why we try so hard to keep pests out of our houses, and when we have to control them, we try to do it in the least invasive way so that we're not exposing animals and pets, people and children, you know, people of all ages to any of the threats. Because you gotta, if it's a risk, if it's a chemical that's used to control insects, obviously there's some sort of risk involved or it wouldn't work. It's a risk to them. So we just have to find out the ones that are not a risk to us. And that's what people work on all the time. Absolutely all the time. Coming up today, there is so much to talk about. I'm happy to say that asking ye shall receive, Lance. We do have some news coming in from our friends at the Max Planck.
So yes.
You'll get a chance.
You know how I feel about Max Planck
Institute. You're as crazy about them as I am. So
well,
that's,
you've taught me over the years. I mean, I look forward to that. Every time you say the Max Planck Institute, I'm like, I'm learning something big today.
They are serious, and they do. One of the things about them also is that their materials that are produced are what are called abstractable. In other words, the next editor can look at 10 pages and turn it into two paragraphs, and it makes sense because they've written it the right way. There's some studies that you can read 10 pages of, but you're still not going to know where the summary is or what to say about it because it's so data driven. But in their case, they're data driven, but they're also results driven. So they try to make sure we get both out of their preachings and results. Corey in Cleveland says, cool to hear about hydrangeas. I just planted a row along the back of our flower beds since it's one of my wife's favorites. How smart is she? How smart are you? What's crazy is that of all six, two of them wilt up towards the end of the day nearly every day, and then they perk back up the next morning. Yeah, and he waters every day. Well, here's the deal. I'd be willing to bet that those two are on the south or west end of the row. And the best thing to do is going to be to plant something slightly taller at the end of the row that can shade them at the end of the day. If it's something else, that's not what's happening, let me know. This is the Garden Mama Show.
We have one voice, the voice of agriculture. We have one job, growing the products you need every day. We have one mission, fighting for agriculture and rural Mississippi. We have you in mind, caring for your private property rights. We are the Mississippi Farm Bureau Federation, 100 years and counting. Become a member today at msfb.org.
You smell that? Spring. Hibernation's over. It's time to run it. Run it until the grass becomes long and the hedges duck and cover. Then, run it again. Steel, get up to $50 off select AK battery tool sets. Offer valid for limited time only at participating dealers while supplies last.
Hey folks, I'm Andy Gibson.
Yes, indeed. I knew that one would be in there.
I've actually played that one in the week, uh-huh. You know, during, in the rotation. Anytime.
Well, it's because it says Francais.
In Francais.
That's right. That gets your attention.
You know it.
And it is indeed a good two-step tune, by the way, y'all. If you want to learn to dance, this is a good place to start. Welcome into the Garden Mama Show. Oh, my goodness. These are just lovely. Paula from Dentville, our buddy, has sent some gorgeous pictures today. She has been gardening up literally a storm. They just look wonderful. I'm tickled. She says she's the petunia, the bubble gums, and the jazzberries are pretty, too. She's right about that. She's absolutely right. As the season goes on and they get leggy is the way to cut them back. Yes, indeed. Just about, usually it happens at mid-June. Sometimes it takes until mid-July, but those spring annual baskets and bowls and pots and things that we have petunias in, and sometimes impatiens, oftentimes, you know, anything that has a little bit of a sprawl to it can get a little leggy and can get a little bit to lose their bottom leaves, maybe, you know, things like that. So that's really the point to give them a haircut. As long as you're leaving two or three sets of leaves below where you cut, that's going to pop right back up again. The point of an annual plant is to set a seed in the season. And as long as you are helping them not to do that, in other words, if you leave those things to go away, leave the bubble gum, they're not going to make a fertile seed. But for instance, they'll just leave all of that on there and let them be leggy. They're going to try to go to seed and you're not going to get any more other growth. But if you will cut them back, whenever they do begin to look leggy, that gives you the opportunity to then fertilize them and start them all up again, because they'll keep doing that as long as the temperatures are good, as long as the fertilizer is present, and as long as they haven't had a chance. You can frustrate them terribly, and that will keep them blooming. That sounds terrible, but it's true. We're keeping them from their natural vision, which is to set a seed and die in one season. That's why they're called an annual.
There's the plant thing. You sit the plant on to keep it kind of up. It's in the pictures that she sent, mm-hmm, and it mm-hmm. is sitting on like a wicker.
Isn't that cute?
Yeah, I was going to say, I, as a kid, I would find those and think, you know, okay, well, I can use those as a tee for, you know, my football. That was not what they were for,
no,
but every time I see one of those, it brings nostalgia.
That was not the intent. That was not the intent.
Yeah, man, that's my kicking tee.
But I have seen that before.
It works great, too, you know. If you're in the yard and you're looking for one.
We have to. Everything has to be multi-use, you know, and it is true that children can find ways to use things that other people may not think of. Grown adults have a little bit more filter, you know.
I don't think my mom was pleased with that.
Probably not. That probably didn't make a big impact on her pleasure, I'm sure.
I don't remember saying anything.
You know. Why do crabs walk sideways?
I don't know. It's the worst dream about crabs, like coming to get me.
Ah.
Back in the old days when I was a kid. I mean, I love eating crabs.
That's interesting.
But they would be coming down the road sideways, you know, and I'd have these, there'd be thousands of them. So if you can, you know, bring that back.
You do have a vivid imagination.
Yeah, it was crazy. So no, that's a good question though, right?
There are almost 8,000. There are more than 7,900 species of crabs, okay? And that's just the true crabs. There are other crabs, but the true crabs are the ones that walk sideways. There are a whole lot more of them because they walk sideways. If you can imagine something that small and relatively not as quick as some things might be, this is all about avoiding the predators. Because, as we all know, you can't evolve if you don't survive.
They were just being antisocial, maybe.
They were trying really hard to go in their own direction, because if the predator is coming towards them and is not aware that they can move sideways, it will throw the thing off, and then the crab is more likely to survive. So those who were able to adapt and begin to run sideways made it, and the others, well, became lunch. So that's why they run sideways. I like it. I like it. That's funny. We get y'all are good. Y'all have some funny jokes. But that's all about the crabs. I had no idea. I mean, 200 million years is longer ago than I can imagine. But that's apparently when this behavior happened, when it became apparent that there were some crabs that were surviving and some that were not.
But it may have just been that they had bad breath, you know, and they were just kind of avoiding each
getting
other.
Away from
they
each
don't
other.
Like eye contact, yeah. You know,
well,
one of those.
And
like,
they're unpredictable because mm-hmm. they could move both directions.
That's right.
You know, their unpredictability did, you know, I'm sure that if there was belching involved, it helped that the other one could move sideways and go somewhere else. That's no question.
I'm going to be dreaming about those crabs again tonight.
See? Well, then let me tell you something. I don't usually recommend television, but in one of the silliest things that is going on right now in television, which I'm just loving terribly, is Chopped on a Desert Island. The Chopped thing where you have to get this basket and cook the ingredients from whatever's in the basket.
I haven't seen this one.
Well, this is a new thing they're doing where they're on a desert island and the basket washes up. Of course, it's all fake, but I mean, it's very dramatic. And one of the things that they pulled out was a crab bigger than them.
Really?
So watch that one.
How are you going to boil that baby?
Well, taking it apart was quite a thing. It was a very interesting thing to watch. It was, but as a person who not only enjoys crabs but is in fact a cancer, I have a great long affection for them. I have artwork with crabs, and Walter Anderson's crab posters very favorites. Just beautiful, beautiful work. And I have to tell you, I had never seen that particular crab before, so I was impressed.
There's nothing like a blue crab, though.
That's true.
Now, I love the crab legs, and there's so much work that goes into eating a blue crab that you almost wonder why you're doing it. But once you get to the meat,
you find out.
Oh, man, it's so sweet and delicious.
Well, and that's what I grew up fishing for, crabbing for, you know. So that's the ones that I grew up on.
That's y'all's neck of the woods. That's a delicacy.
Gulfport, Mississippi, thank you very much. The pier that is no longer there. There's plenty of piers there.
We used to get some good ones down there and around that area, Gulfport and all that.
Sure.
Some friends that knew people, and you'd get a mess of them.
That's there were processing houses and all that sort of stuff. But my great aunt, who was a tiny woman with a big heart and a very large crab net, taught us all to catch dinner.
It was a good lesson.
So that was kind of fun. That was kind of fun.
I remember as a kid going to the beach, and you would see so many people out flounder fishing too.
Oh.
You don't see that anymore either, but that was like something everyone seemed to do for a long time. And then you go down there now, and it's like everybody's out there on their phone, you know, just walking around looking at the crabs.
Speaking of the coast, Ray in Long Beach just sent us his 2-day harvest of cherry tomatoes, which is extremely ample.
Y'all,
you need to go to supertalk.tv, y'all. These are the best plant pictures and produce pictures you're going to see anywhere. I'm sorry, we do better than anybody else.
Definitely.
We don't have an archive yet, but we're going to.
We're fortunate to be in a state where people know how to grow stuff.
That's right.
That's our largest industry also, agriculture. So you kind of have to embrace it, right?
Well, I mean, if you have any sense.
Exactly. If you see what our folks are growing here.
And that's the other piece of this now. There's absolutely a new word, y'all. I've been trying to figure out how to describe us because we're different. This group of it's not manic gardeners. It's not a merry band of horticulture people, because but we are not a club either, and neither are we an association. Okay, so the new word is a sodality. We are a sodality, and we're going to have to start. I think I might put it on a T-shirt. I'm not sure, but when the members come together for the same cause, and in this case, it is growing better and living better, and that's really all we're about: is better gardening, better life through better gardening, and as a result, that's different. You know, we might be a club because we all like plants, or we might be an association because we're devoted to, I don't know, restoring hostas, or you know what I mean, something particular. But in this case, we're just the sodality. We're the people who love to garden, and this is why we come together in this particular format here. Wow, that's a very impressive tomato plant that you're showing me, Lance. We got some tomato growers around here.
Definitely.
Y'all.
I'll have to jump into the cherry tomato game someday. I haven't gone that route yet.
But. I love them. And plus, if you just are the least bit careful with them, I did pull 4 green tomato hornworms off of mine yesterday, and I was not saying words I can share with you here, and I did consign them to a rather sad fate. But if you like tomatoes, and if you've ever liked any cherry tomato, you're going to like the ones you grow better. And you're also going to like the fact that by the time it gets to Thanksgiving, you've still got tomatoes.
Well, I wish you would have recorded your Yosemite Sam laced conversation with your plant.
I just have to go see whether they got any more today, because they were green and small, so they were just hatching. So I have to go watch for some more. Beginning to get blueberries. Beautiful, Jim. That looks great. Really, really nice. Can I trim the blackberry stems that will provide blackberries next year? Not until after you harvest. you can prune as necessary, but I'm not one to say prune new canes unless, I mean, let me take that back. If you've got a plant that's 3 feet tall and one cane, for some reason or another, brand new cane shoots up from the ground level and is 6 feet tall in a month, I'd probably cut that one because it's taking a lot of energy away from the rest of the plant. But I wouldn't do it unless it was an exceptional circumstance. Blueberries are beautiful, though. Look lovely, lovely. Paula's telling us about canning cherry tomatoes. That's a very good tomato, but I'll tell you what else it's good for is pickling. And it makes a delicious, delicious pickle. Really does. Wonderful, wonderful. Oh, thank you for putting up the straw flower photo and the native monarda, the native bee balm. I am in love with that flower. Oh, my goodness. I like red bee balm. I like the one that we see more often. But there's just something about, it's the same reason I like nigella, I think. Because it has so many funny little petals and such an odd, twisted design of the flower. It's just beautiful. Ooh, sunflowers. You still growing sunflowers?
I am. They're slowly, they're probably at 4.5 feet right now. So they're definitely putting on some length.
That needs that heat. They'll appreciate it when it's a little bit warmer. Oh, what a beautiful portulaca. That's lovely. This is interesting. This is a photo of what I believe are cloches. I think these people probably planted new shrubs, and they're trying to keep them from getting drowned is what it looks like. But they're little cloches dropped on top of plants. And so, I mean, I can't see what's underneath them, obviously. But he says he sees them all over the place. And usually that's a protective device. That's all. Gloria, your lilies are beautiful. Oh, my goodness. What a gorgeous pink. That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Wonderful. Man, goodness.
Just beautiful.
Y'all got some picks today.
Man, this rain has been good for a lot of things.
Yeah.
John's driving along. He had a tomato worm eat the entire plant down. Yeah. Yeah, it does happen. But the tomato plant grew back stronger and was more fruitful than it was before. It is amazing. He's absolutely right about that. When something happens to a plant that is determined to produce, it's what trees will, after they're knocked off by lightning or something, they'll send out a branch that's only on the left side of the tree. There's no reason for that, but that's what they could do, so that's what they did. And in the case of things like tomatoes, sometimes it's just basically like they got pruned. The worms ate them, took them all the way down to nothing, and the plant's response, if it does not continue to be devoured, is to go ahead and send up some new leaves and let's get busy. Let's make some more plants, make some more fruit. And I think that's what happened. I love that. I really appreciate it. He's gone 4 days out of the week, so he plays catch up in the garden when he gets back. And that, I understand that. That's a difficult thing, but you're definitely keeping up with it. That's wonderful. Terrific, terrific, terrific. So much fun. So much crazy stuff in my garden at this particular moment. Some of the hidden gingers are blooming, the lilies are blooming, and we're running out of the spring wildflower bunch, the Calyopsis that were blooming have just about faded out. So that's a big change, at times. Beautiful, Paula. She's loving the rain. She's planted hedges. Yeah, they do need a lot of rain. That's good. That's good. University College of London would like you to know that it's not just the crabs that evolved based on who was trying to eat them. Guess who won the fights with T-Rex? That would be T-Rex, okay? But you look at that thing and you think, surely they got the wrong fossil. Those little arms couldn't really be the thing. We've all seen that and thought it was funny, right?
Jazz hands, yeah.
Yeah. Well, guess what? Their heads grew faster than their arms did when they were becoming creatures. Their heads began to be the dominant battering ram or the dominant thing that they used to kill other things to eat them. And so as a result, the head grew and the arms didn't because they didn't need the arms. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, they can't even, if they get an itch on the toe, they got to use their head.
Well, that's right. As the teeth and mouth and jaws got stronger, the hands went, we don't have anything to do. We can just be the jazz hands,
sing and dance. It's good for dancing, right?
Exactly. But we don't have to do the rest of it. I think that's hilarious. My goodness. Oh, my, my, my. You know, nature's pretty amazing. We're seeing some pretty amazing nature, and we have, if we look back, we see a whole lot of it. Love getting your pictures. Hope you'll send us some more. This is the Garden Mama Show.
It's a laid-back Sunday afternoon. Your wish will never end.
The homemade taste of bluebell and good friends gathered round. The good old days are being made right now.
Like our original gold-rimmed bluebell homemade vanilla, the country's gold standard of ice cream flavors since 1969. Its hand-cranked taste takes you back to simpler times. That's why we put the word home right on the carton.
The good old days are being made right now.
The good old days are being made right now.
Look for Bluebell ice cream at your local grocer and pick up your favorite flavor today.
Here's a tale of team.
I like them. That's one of those, you know, the vaults.
Yes.
It's like Al Capone's vault, but this is Nelly's vault.
There's just some in there that are, you think to yourself, nobody's ever going to hear this again. Well, they're going to hear it today.
Yeah, we're going through the 401s today.
See what we can find out.
Good stuff in there. Like I said, I knew they were there because I pulled a couple of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and the other problem, of course, is that there's so many places where there's music this is old, many years and many systems put in on top of other systems.
Oh,
so I have
goodness,
to go in and
so
find them. You
so
know.
Many layers.
But when I have a nice round of 4-0s. Next week we'll do 6-0s.
Yeah. You use the 6-0s a good bit.
Use those a lot.
They're a little more instrumental. But like that one's named mm-hmm. Funky. You know,
Funky,
I've used that one before. So when you say it's old, you're like, yeah, I played it because it's got a last play date over there. If you do this every day, you kind of want to make sure you're not playing something too often. Because there's so much music, or never, right? You know, finding the way you hit the sift, on the filter over there and see which ones haven't been played like since 2015. I'll go through some of those sometimes.
Yeah, it's a minute.
Yeah,
but that's why we collect the music and put it in there. And that's why we're so happy we have computers with lots of memory, so we can keep all that stuff. It's fun. These are lovely. Mary's got a volunteer tomato, and I'll bet you it is aroma. She's got a beautiful cluster. That's delightful. That's really sweet. I love seeing that. I have Celebrity, and I have Cherokee Purple, and I have, I can't remember which cherry tomato I finally decided on. I think I purchased one and planted one that I had seeded, but I don't know which one came, which one actually turned into the plant. Probably Super 1000 or something, one of those modern ones, but they're fun. Just because I promised this, and I know there's people tuning in and out all the time, I have to take you to the Max Planck Institute of Geoanthropology, reporting in Nature magazine. This is not baloney, folks. This is a biggie. They don't do anything that isn't, it's literally, it's as if you went into your kitchen and made a recipe, and then all your neighbors came over to see if they liked it. And could duplicate it, So all of that at one time has to go into these studies. The rainforest discovery that they are telling us now has been lost for 150,000 years, my friends. Really does change how we look at human history. I really love this. They believe that our species, Homo sapiens, us, were actually more adaptable than they used to think. You think? How did we survive this long? That's how. But anyway. in what they have found from studying in West Africa, the evidence is that they were living in the rainforest. They didn't used to think that we did this. They thought that we were limited to other kinds of environments, and so therefore those areas were not inhabited, but that turns out not to be true. Turns out we were all looking for some shade, and we probably found a lot of it in the rainforest. But I love this. They studied, the Ivorians and the Soviets at that time, this is back in the 80s, found this place. And then they eventually found another team more recently that's able to excavate it and make sure and find out what it all is. So what they found out when they excavated was that this just wasn't a place where they had wandered through, you know, this which is what they had thought before, was that, yeah, there was evidence that Homo sapiens were there, but oh, so what? Well, there were tools buried in the excavation. Once they got down below the surface, because, you know, let's face it, the rainforest floor builds up every year and gets larger and deeper and thicker in different places. So by the time they excavated, they were able to find stone tools in what is now an actual, what would be a rainforest. It's fascinating stuff. They didn't know that. They did not know that they knew we'd been there, but they didn't know we had ever lived there. And what they found out from this, the international team returned. And of course, because 40 years ago, we didn't have ground penetrating radar that they could haul out in a mobile unit, you know, on your back and go and look for stuff. They're able to find things now that they weren't able to. So I'm tickled that Max Planck folks, they have obviously a huge endowment, but they do a lot of work to keep current science topics at the front of people's minds so that they can see what they're supporting and they can understand what they're working on. And there's no question but that human beings and our origins is a big deal. So they're giving us a piece of information that we did not know. 150,000 years we were living there.
Yeah, it's amazing. To me, you would think that would be a natural fit for human beings, yeah, to look for the shade, yeah, the rainforest,
exactly,
where there's ample water, fresh, fresh greenery and all kind of stuff, the shade and, you know, the being able to build, some type of decent structures, because you got wood, right,
yeah,
there.
Well, yeah.
And some protection from the elements.
More food sources than you would have in the desert, or more readily available ones anyway.
One of the cool things I think about Mexico is that you got the Yucatan, which is basically a big limestone shelf. And it's almost a rainforest, I would say, but
it's,
you see.
It's a lot.
Yeah,
there,
you can see pictures if you just, about the horizon level, wherever there's a bump above the tree line, which is pretty high. Mm-hmm. Is it, mm-hmm, some type, mm-hmm, of structure that was built and it's been overgrown for, however many years, several hundred years that it's been. So you can only imagine, you're talking about 150,000 years, what's under there.
Exactly, exactly. I guess that's one of the reasons I was so distressed by the incident that happened on the Yucatan. It happened at the pyramids, because that's just such a precious place. You don't think of it as being something that anybody would even want to despoil.
No way. I mean, there's hundreds and potentially thousands that are still
underneath something else. Right. That's right. They're underneath something else. That's absolutely true.
And they know they're there. They just don't have the resources. Obviously, extremely expensive.
On the mainland part of Mexico, of course, the rainforests are spectacular, and you're able to ride, you're able to drive in your car or ride on a bus along the edges on what roads that appear to be too narrow for the vehicle that you're in.
Yeah, basically Daytona Beach in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a kind of exciting thing. But then, of course, you get to where you're going and you go hiking and you're able to descend into these gigantic canyons. And it's a rainforest. It's magnificent and it's beautiful. In the state of Michoacán is where I experienced this. And it was the greenest place that I have ever personally been. It was just spectacular. And I just see those as places where you would hope no one would want to tear that apart. I feel that way about Avery Island, frankly. I have that same kind of had that experience there. Now you could see the sky on Avery Island, so that's a little different, but it has that same kind of haunting and spiritual quality to it, because it is it's so deeply involved in the earth and the way things grow. It's a magnificent trip. I hope you all get to take that one. It's not that far away, I promise. By the way, this is a cutie now. This is one that everybody would like to see. But the first thing on the post is the apologies for the picture quality, and I don't seem to be able to sharpen it up any, but it's a robo mower.
Yeah.
You can sit and watch your lawn get mowed. I love that. I'm still trying to figure out, well, whose house did they build those roving vacuums for. It wasn't mine. They don't do doorways, and they don't do edges, and they don't do, and it all has to be very normal for them. But I guess your lawn does too, but it's more likely to be a nice big rectangle or square, which would be handy for this thing. Pretty cool, though.
They learn quickly, they say, how to cut your yard. I know Rebel Ace, one of our great sponsors for the Handyman Show, has a full line of the Crest.
Oh, yeah.
I've gone out and researched them. The
lawn ones make more sense to me than the house ones.
Right. Well, and you go from the price of a kind of zero turn all the way up to if you're buying a Kubota tractor. I mean, the price, they're out all over the place as far as the price goes.
Yeah,
I guess
that's
so,
true.
Depending on the size that you want. But I see them using them on the reservoir on the bank. Yeah, mm-hmm, one of the mm-hmm. crews has them, and they're pretty cool.
Well, when you can't find goats, you know, you kind of have to go ahead and get a robo mower.
Of a job.
Well, there are not a lot of things that I think I probably should have done, but one of them was to have goat mowers. You know, to be the person that brought the goat mowers to your place. I think I would have enjoyed that. I like goats a lot. Ray in Long Beach, there is a robo mower in the yard at Bayside Park in subdivision in Waveland. See. Everybody's getting hip. See, here's another good one, y'all. This is Booker T and the MGs playing music from The Graduate, Mrs. Robinson. We'll be back.
State Treasurer David McRae has returned more unclaimed money and delivered more college and career savings to Mississippians than ever before. He's done it by making the state's education savings programs more flexible, benefiting students and teachers at virtually all schools, private or public, vocational or technical. He's making college and career savings and getting unclaimed money easier than ever. Don't let another day go by without claiming your cash or jumpstarting a career. Treasury.ms.gov.
I'm Commissioner Sean Tindall from the Mississippi Department of Public Safety. Did you know that every time you get behind the wheel, one simple decision can save your life? Wearing your seatbelt takes just a second, but it can make all the difference in a crash. Law enforcement from across Mississippi are stepping up patrols and watching closely. If you're not buckled up, you will be stopped and you will be ticketed. No excuses, no warning. Click it or ticket, Mississippi.
We've sent that Rip Van Winkle.
So my thanks to them. It was a great time. Really, really just a wonderful market. And anywhere near there, you ought to go. So that's go see them. Another thing I need to tell you about today, and I don't usually do this without knowing exactly, but the release date is coming up very soon for a book that I want you to get for your dad. This is Wildcrafted Garden Structures, Father's Day in a few weeks. You can certainly pre-order it if it isn't already on the bookshelves, but I think it is. My friend Jim Long, years ago, began doing a lot of things that other folks, kind of bringing back stuff that people hadn't thought about and bringing into this whole business of bentwood structures, making more out of what's left over. You know, you may have seen wattle fences, and in fact, if you have gone up the Natchez Trace, you will see that kind of thing where the wood is just laid into the wood, and so they nest and they make a fence that way. We think about doing that in our own gardens for a little barrier for things. But you can also make trellises and pergolas and benches and chairs and all kind of stuff. And his new book, this is the culmination of other books that he has written on the subject that were much smaller. And this is the big one. This is the coup de grace, as we are proud to say. And we're going to talk to him in a couple of weeks. But it's an art form, and it is absolutely something that everybody can do. And if you, like me, have ever looked at all that stuff that falls down after a storm or the things that you've had to prune, and you say, what can I do with this? There's a million ideas here, and you will put them all to work. Wildcrafted Garden Structures, Story Publishing, and my friend Jim Long. Jim Long, of course, came to prominence for a number of reasons. One of them in our world is that he created something that nobody else created, and that was some herbal soaks and things that made so much sense. Been using them. Their Long Creek Herb Farm is just a magnificent place, and I've shown you pictures of it before. But there's so much there, so go to Long Creek Farms online and get yourself a copy of Wildcrafted Garden Structures. I love it. So happy. Paula says, she has too many dogs for a robo vacuum. might need higher capacity. You know, that is true. Go 3 feet and go, I'm done. You
know? That'd be like kind of like a new age Looney Tunes, you know.
Might be. Could be a very interesting, but not necessarily a healthy situation. I can imagine the one going around your house having the same difficulty with all your animals. Ken wants to know, how do I propagate this red prayer plant? The answer is you don't. You're lucky. You are lucky, because they oftentimes don't have this many leaves on them in a container at all. And I can still see the soil surface, so this one does not need to be propagated. When you do see shoots coming up from the side of it, on the side of the pot, that's the point where you can unpot it and break those pieces off, and that's how you propagate it. But you don't want to disturb this particular center clump on the Marantas, whether it's the prayer plant that you think of regularly or whether you think of this particular red one. Either of those are not going to respond well to being divided. Now, okay, everything has a caveat. If somebody gives you a plant that's a Maranta, that's a prayer plant, and it only has 6 inches of stem and a leaf on the end of all of it, yeah, okay, you're going to take that and cut it apart and to get it to send up some new shoots from its base. But when you have a beautiful one like this, you don't need to propagate it. You may need to move it up to a larger container, or you may need to fertilize it on a more regular basis to keep it stocky. But it's lovely. You should keep it and enjoy it. There's no question about that. Today is I tell you, some of these are weird today. We're going to do that other thing another day, because I decided there were too many that were fun today. But, Wendy, how do you suppose we decided that we were going to say wig out? Why did we begin to talk about wigging out? Who wigged out? And does it actually mean that your wig comes off? I mean, I don't know exactly, but the idea comes from so many things come from cartoons. The idea that something would be so wild and crazy that it would literally blow your wig off, and the picture is of the person with their hair flying off their head. The term has become to be like the positive correspondent to meltdown. Okay, if you melt down, that's not good. You're having a meltdown, that's not good. We get that from nuclear reactors. We know that's not a positive expression, but wig out actually tends to be a little bit more exciting. It's oftentimes taken to be such simple stuff, you know. In urban slang, it's to lose control of your emotions, to just go on a rant, for example, to react wildly, and it does in fact go to the old expressions of freak out and meltdown and carry on and all those kinds of things. But it's an interesting thing that we need a day for it. I had no idea that we needed a day to wig out. I thought we just wigged out from time to time.
Yeah, the same is basically as apoplectic, right?
I think so. I think so.
Wig out is just a more descriptive way of describing it.
It's considered to be brought on by shock or anger or even just stress. And when I think of me wigging out, I literally turn the world off, you know, when something makes me so crazy that I want to wig out or shocks me. What can shock me at this point? Plenty of things, actually. But it also can be a fear response. Same thing as fight or flight. You know, you respond one way or the other when you're scared. And I think in the case of wig out, it goes directly to that.
Well, and it came about in the 40s or 50s.
Yeah.
I kind of recall what wig out did.
Yeah,
you would imagine maybe that had something to do with like the showing up of the flying saucers, you know, things that were so different.
Certainly.
Then it would just blow your wig off. You know?
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Big things.
Things will blow your wig off, as they say, you know. Oh, John, here's a good question. John's in Florence. Is it possible to dig up and move a cypress knee? No, you would have to cut it off at ground level to take it. And you mean you could dig it up. You'd be there for a while because it's as big as it is on the outside. That's how big the root is that's attaching it to the mother tree. There are places where we grow cypress trees and do not allow those to form, and there's a whole controversy about where you should grow cypress trees anyway. But if you've got the cypress knees, they are functioning for the tree. On the other hand, if the tree is gone and the knees are there, well, you have art. So you can dig them up, but you're going to be more likely to cut them off at ground level by the time you get out there. So I'm it becomes an art object after it's removed from the tree that it is supporting.
Well, and when they're growing like that in the swamp, when you're wearing rubber boots in the middle of the winter, they're extremely great for creating some obstacles that you'll end up on your back.
That's
or,
true.
You know,
that's very
face
true.
Plant into the. Yeah, I love that. They're so pretty though. When we'll have a flood here and there, and some of them will get, they'll be underwater for too long, and you can just basically pull them out.
Yeah, that will happen.
Yeah,
because they become disassociated.
They do,
but that's because another one's growing up underneath it to support that tree.
Always.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Which is also another hazard.
Yeah. There you go. Another obstacle.
I was pretty old before I realized that. All those houses with cypress knees that had been drilled through and put lamps in them, you know, that they were, that was not a great thing. Because they're very cool looking. But when you realize that there was, it's just like when they started using Spanish moss to stuff mattresses with, they took up almost all the Spanish moss. And as someone has said more than once, if they just could have figured out a way to stuff the nutria into something, we wouldn't have so many nutria to worry about. But we didn't get that, you know, in this world. So it's a trade-off. It's always a trade-off. The cypress knees are working for the tree. They work against us at times, and sometimes we do things to them that hopefully just, if you dig up one, it's not going to hurt the tree, I wouldn't imagine. But when you go in and take them all out in the way that they did when they decided to make them into objects and furniture, it hurts the trees. And so that's that. Does that make any sense? I hope so. Good question, though. People should think about it before they start messing with stuff like that. Today is Reed Instrument Day. Today is Reed Day. And since I don't know anybody named Reed, no offense if your name is Reed, it's a great name. I took that, when I thought about it, I took it to mean Reed Instruments. It wasn't until later that someone said, well, it might be people named Reed. Okay, well, maybe so. But why did we decide we were going to put this thing in our mouth and have it vibrate and make sense? You know, it's not the oldest one, but the one that is the most dramatic, I guess, is the harmonica, because you're basically just blowing into something, and the reed itself is what's vibrating and making the sound. And the way that you shape the noise that you put in it, the way that you shape the air that goes through it, is what makes the sound of the harmonica. So it's to me, that's kind of the classic reeded instrument. But you know, I've got to say that I did, in fact, try to play once or twice in my life an oboe and even the snake charmer's flute.
Yeah, what is that one called? Yeah, it's like an India guy's got, he's sitting there cross-legged, and there's the cobra.
Well, that's the punji.
Oh, the punji, okay.
Yeah, we tried to do that. I was not successful, even though I was a flute player. I couldn't get a sound out of it. But, of course, the bagpipe is another, and the duduk and all those things that have, they're double-reeded. And so it's partly the vibration of the air, but it's also the way that you clutch the reed itself with the mouthpiece of the instrument, which is why bagpipes do sound distinct, different, depending on who's playing them. For those of you who have never thought that, I promise it's true. They do sound different. Depending on who's playing it, because of the reed. So accordions and all those sort of stuff, those have reeds that you work with your hands, but the rest of them are intended, for example, clarinets and saxophones and oboes even are the things that are intended to be in the mouthpiece of the thing. Why do we do this? Why do we have these things? Well, I don't really know, but when I was a kid and was found out that I was in the woodwind group because I played flute and we were learning clarinet and stuff like that, we were told that the reason reeds were invented and the reason mouthpieces like on the flute and on some of these other fife and those other kinds of instruments were because people had a lot of time on their hands and they were looking for something to do. Now, I don't know if that's true, but that's what my teacher told me, so I'm willing to pass it along to you. Why else would we decide to put two reeds into the oboe? How did we have time to even think of that? Well, we had time to think of that. So when you're looking for time, sometimes you find it. And in their cases, they were looking for ways to be more interesting, ways to make the song they were singing or the story they were telling stand out from all the others. I think that's just pretty cool.
Somebody in the background would hit it, maestro.
Sure.
That's the first time music was played behind a story, you know?
That's
I
right.
want to know when that happened.
Ooh.
It was the first time there was somebody lecturing.
Yeah.
And the wife was like, look, everybody's heard this 20 times.
They're falling asleep.
You over there. Come here. Blowing this wine bottle or something.
let's see what you can do with this. And it makes sense. I mean, come on, it's a little silly, but on the other hand, it makes sense. You got to get those things to work for people. We have to find ways to fill the space between minutes, and that's what sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it's with research, sometimes it's with just going out and what doing what I call watching the garden. You know, it may not be doing anything, but I'm watching it, and that's kind of a fun thing. I did not realize until very recently that there's how much work there is still. I thought they'd already figured out they couldn't do much about it. But the Asian citrus psyllids have been a tremendous problem for the citrus industry worldwide, actually, but certainly including the southern United States. What happens is that they do feed on the sap of the tree, but they also spread a deadly bacterium. And that's the biggest problem, of course, that causes the citrus greening disease. Which has a name about this long that I can't pronounce. But most of them die, and that's really what is so devastating. So the psyllid itself is the vector for the disease that causes the death of the tree. So what we're trying to find out, but in these tests at the University of Florida, were to figure out, well, what'll eat them and what eats them the most efficiently. And in this case, what they've been working on, they've been working through the insidious flower bug, which is also called the minute pirate bug, if you know that one. One of the green lacewings, the particular one, a particular lady beetle that's known as the mealybug destroyer, and another predatory mite. So they've been doing some work to try and figure out which ones were going to do the best job, and they have come up with some results that are exciting for all of us. What they've been finding out, of course, is that how effective they are depends on the situation. So they're putting together some protocols to help with what they will do once they are able to introduce these into an environment that lets them test them even more deeply. But in, you know me, I'm going to say, let's release all of them and see which ones do well. And if I had an orchard, that's what I would want to do. So the best results were obtained with the lacewing adults and the mealybug destroyer larvae. So that's good to know. It's important. And it's another reason why when you have a pest, you don't want to have nuclear response. You want to control the pest that is the problem without damaging the other critters in the environment, because some of them may be the thing that is actually going to help you get rid of that problem down the way. It's important to know. I've been potting up basils. I've been potting up some really pretty nicotianas. And I'm thinking now that this week is going to be the week I'm finally going to put out caladiums and begonias in pots. I've had them in a little bit of protection from all this rain, but I think it's going to let up in a couple of days. That's a cute one, Paula. I like it. I don't know who the character is, but I like the music. That's delightful. Thank you for that. Fun. There are a lot of things we worry about in this world, you know. We worry about why crabs walk sideways. We worry about what's going to take care of this problem that we have in citrus. And how maybe we do need to start growing more of these predatory insects. That might be smart. Meanwhile, the humpback whales are just cruising. Do you know that since we have begun to put devices on whales to let us follow their migration, this is the longest one, more than 9,000 miles. Can you imagine? That's a long way.
It's like Magellan.
Exactly. They have gone open ocean. One whale shattered the records between the sightings, between the, you know, registering it, and made it the longest journey. I think maybe we have to call that one Magellan.
Yeah, that's what I'm, yeah, that's perfect, huh?
Let's name it.
I want to know who competitor is.
And of course, they're traveling between Australia and Brazil to get to their breeding grounds. Well, I mean, come on, that's a pretty horrible setup. That's a lot of distance.
Yeah, it's a lot of distance, a lot of cold water in there, too.
That's a lot, and it's winter there right now, by the way.
Yeah, that's cold down yonder.
Anyway, something to think about. At least you're not having, when you think your commute's bad, at least you're not a humpback whale. That's all I can tell you. Oh, fun. I hadn't heard this in a long time. All right, we're going to listen to a little bit of music, step away, hear some from our great advertisers, and welcome you back to more of the Garden Mama Show.
Customers are searching online for the services they need.
Are they looking at your business?
Having a mobile-friendly website can really help you win new customers. Let SuperTalk Mississippi Media create a great-looking and very affordable website for your business. Plus, studies suggest that a well-written radio ad can lead to a 20% lift in traffic to your website. Just call SuperTalk Mississippi Media today at 601-991-2305 or go to stmmdigital.com.
Pine Grove Behavioral Health and Addiction Services, located in Hattiesburg, is one of the nation's most comprehensive treatment campuses. Pine Grove provides the highest quality mental health care and addiction treatment for children, adolescents, and adults. Pine Grove offers many levels of care, including inpatient and outpatient treatment for children and adolescents. If you have any questions, please call 1-888-574-HOPE and visit pinegrovetreatment.com.
We've sent that Rip Van Winkle.
This one makes me want to go to the Caribbean.
Yep. Soul Limbo, huh? I think.
Yeah, you nailed it. You're good. Like Cuba, you know?
Yeah. Ry Cooter could just come walking in. Welcome back, friends. Welcome back. How, my goodness, we're having fun. We're talking about SpongeBob and Squidward on the text line.
That fantastic world that they created.
Just, yes, truly, truly. I've had the pleasure of attending birthday parties where adults dressed as all the characters,
sure,
not just children.
So when anyone can get into SpongeBob.
I hope so. My goodness. He's certainly fun. Oh, nice, Nathan. Thank you. Nathan's picking up a trailer at the local Lowe's there in Laurel, and they have a really nice display out to honor, recognize Memorial Day and honor those who have sacrificed themselves for us. That's very nice. I like seeing that kind of thing. Really nice. Y'all are filling up the text line. Thank you all very, very much. Mealybugs have appeared on a couple of my indoor plants. I've done the alcohol treatment several times. Would putting them outside a couple of days help or hinder the eradication of this pest? Actually, it won't make much difference unless it happens that it could get rained on real hard and maybe drown some of them, because that does happen in outdoors. But if they're not growing quickly enough, you think they need more humidity to get over the situation, certainly putting them outside wouldn't hurt. I will say, though, that after the alcohol doesn't work, the next thing is generally... And by the way, what you're doing, for those of you who may not know, mealybugs are white masses of gooey things that happen, like, for example, on the branch of a philodendron, or maybe in the crevice where a Dracaena leaf comes out from the stem. They take advantage of tender places on your plants to set up housekeeping. So if you take a paintbrush with a little bit of rubbing alcohol on it and hold it onto them, they will die. But that doesn't necessarily kill all of their eggs or all of the others that you can't see yet, because they haven't revealed themselves. So that's why, in general, we say do that every 8 days, because that's how long it takes for one of the eggs to hatch. So if you go on and coat the plant today and then do it again in 8 days, generally speaking, you're going to get better control after about 2 or 3 rounds of that. If that's not happening, it just means you have a tougher group of insects, and you'll want to switch to something like insecticidal soap, which you can still use indoors, but which will have a greater effect as an insecticide. So that would be my suggestion. You can certainly put them outside if you believe that will help. And it might, but it might not. It also may be that you just need to do this on a more regular basis, every 8 days, or that you want to switch over to insecticidal soap. Either of those things should help. Paula and I agree that SpongeBob, she didn't say this, but she said it. You pick up on other things about it when you're an adult. I say that's absolutely true, and that's why you ought to go back and watch Rocky and Bullwinkle if you haven't.
Oh, goodness, Natasha.
So many choices in that world.
You know, that was never my favorite growing up, Rocky and Bullwinkle, because it seemed like it was such a throwback. Looney Tunes and those. It was a little rougher.
Yeah.
But once I kind of got it, you know, because it was, what did it come out in the 50s? So, you know, in the 70s as a kid.
60s, I think.
Let's see. I'm looking it up. It originally, Rocky and Bullwinkle originally aired on November 19th, 59.
Okay.
To June 64. Yeah.
Because that's when I would have seen it as a kid in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
But here's the deal. For us, it was so much more sophisticated than Bugs Bunny. No offense to Bugs, we love Bugs, but we were looking for some of those funnier jokes that we didn't quite get.
Mm-hmm.
And Rocky and Bullwinkle had plenty of those.
Yeah. You had the Russians in there, which was so great.
Which was so
Boris
funny.
And Natasha.
I mean, come on, you know, it's just silly stuff.
Yeah.
But though, anything like that, the things that really do work in children's art and children's entertainment that way are the things that have layers to them. Because as everybody who's ever been around kids for any length of time knows, they're smarter than you think they are. And they'll get bored with it if it doesn't have layers. So that's really why SpongeBob and all these things are so popular. Corinne sent these beautiful images. She has heard that it would be helpful to mix some sand into sweet potatoes with the potting soil. That's true. You need to break it up a little bit. You could use something called soil conditioner. It's a finely ground bark. Or you could use sharp sand. You could even use perlite if you happen to have some of that. What you're trying to do is just make sure that the soil is loose enough, and potting soil does tend to sometimes get really thick and dense, and those roots need to be able to spread, and they need to be able to spread quickly to support sweet potatoes. So give yourself a little bit of a benefit there. I think you're right. And she's still got some slips growing from the original mother sweet potatoes. You are so industrious. My goodness, Corinne, this is great. So she wants to know, can she pull them off and root them and plant them too? I'm going to say it's still May, yes. Go ahead and do that. You're going to have a whole lot by the time by the time you get done with them, that you will have plenty. Amanda, beautiful, beautiful first picking of the green beans, fresh green beans this morning in Pike County. Lovely, lovely, lovely. That's what I always feel like, the end of May is when we should be getting a chance to do that. That's fun stuff. Really nice. That is just beautiful. Yellow butterflies and what else is in there? Looks like petunias. If I could just jump into the picture, you know, transport myself, I could see it even better. That's lovely. Really beautiful. Just lovely. We do have some hope on our front, our issue that we're always thinking about, the microplastics. As you know, microplastics have been found in every bit of water on our earth, every body of water, and their concentrations in fish and other aquatic creatures is a little troubling, to say the least. So a lot of work has been done, but especially Adelaide University seems to be where this comes up a lot. They're trying to figure out a way to just use it. You know, in other words, if we have the microplastics and we're going to harvest them from the oceans or from the whatever, let's find a way to use them. I tend to lean towards the things that say let's replace them in the products that we're already using them in. There must be something else. But you got to work from both ends of a big problem like this, so I appreciate them doing this. They have figured out, because it's Adelaide, and let's face it, if anybody's got sunshine, they've got sunshine. Scientists are using sunlight to turn that plastic waste into clean fuels like hydrogen, which could be a breakthrough solution not only to dealing with the plastic, but then also dealing with the microplastics and the other forms of plastic that we've not been able to do something with. This could possibly turn it into part of the low-carbon future that would allow us to have energy, have plenty of energy, but just like batteries are so important for storing it, We do have to have ways to keep the plastic from just piling up around us. And if we can turn that into hydrogen, we'd be doing a pretty good thing. The Adelaide University PhD candidates, and they are converting waste plastics with solar-powered systems into hydrogen and then into other industrial chemicals through that process. So that could really help. If we can find a way to make that a circle, you know, rather than we do all these things and then we just toss the stuff out. If we could actually make it a circle where it feeds upon itself, we would be much, much better off. And working with the University of Missouri Columbia, they're now telling us that we've got even a different approach to a different plastic. This is the microplastics, particularly that the other one is intended to turn that into something. This is in turn of removing it from drinking water, because that's really one of the big problems. When we find it in every water source, then why are we consuming it? This is not something we would ordinarily consume, so why are we doing that? And in this particular case, it's all things orange-scented algae. Orange-scented algae, what even is that? Well, it's a thing. They have created a special kind of algae, and it grabs microscopic plastic pollution out of the water. It's not magnetic, but it has a magnetic effect. It attracts those particular things. That's because it produces limonene, and that is the product. Obviously, it sounds like citrus. It smells like oranges, but that's what binds to the microplastic particles. It's an amazing discovery, amazing development. If we can turn it into something bigger, then we would be much better off, because it's really hard to get teeny microplastics out of the water. But if you can get them to clump up, then you would be able to remove them with many systems, and that makes a tremendous amount of sense. Besides that, it cleans the wastewater while it's working. The algae does. The algae, while it's working, it also filters the water that it is taking the plastics out of. Now, I'm telling you, I didn't even know you could develop kinds of algae. I thought algae was pretty much algae. But I suppose you can genetically modify almost anything, and it makes a whole lot of sense to do it in this particular case. We have a lot of issues. We all have feelings about how we're going to do things. Are we going to do them in the way of genetic modification, or are we going to not do them that way? People will argue about it. People will take very strong lines about it. Just like almost everything else, I'm more in the middle. I'm more the person who says, let's see what the risk of using them is, but also what the reward is. And if we can use these algae to get microplastics out of the ocean, out of the drinking water, I'm for it. I'll go for that one. Just beautiful stuff.
I was watching a documentary the other day about similar things. It started off with the microplastics, and then it went to all the stuff in outer space. And then you're like, oh my God, when it showed like a live Doppler type of deal, you'd see.
Oh my goodness.
And in the actual cloud of junk circling the Earth from all of the space debris from satellites and all those things. It's amazing that in the time we live now, where space travel and getting into that area is much more prevalent, that all that space junk is like, you know, darts and bullets just flying through the air, and that there's been several, you know, the flights that have been hit by these things.
They can be a compromising factor.
You're like, oh man. So thinking of all the junk that we create, we've got to find a better way of using these things.
Seriously, because we're not going to be able to just walk off and leave it.
No.
You know?
Yeah. And you think you've got a cloud of metal dust floating around the Earth.
There's plenty of science fiction that revolves around what happens after the stuff hits the...
Yeah.
You know? And so we don't need that. We need to prevent those things. And that is certainly an issue. If there's not somebody working on it, I'd be surprised, because it is a very difficult thing. That one of the things that, just like you hear about all of the plastic in the ocean that finds its way to each other, it's not quite water world, but almost, you know, the plastic conducts itself in such ways that the way the currents flow, those things all end up in one big lump in places. They don't join together, but they are physically located together. It's the same way I understand in space, that there are certain winds and certain currents and certain forces, the gravity of this place or the non-gravity of that place, which causes those things to end up in a big enough, I mean, this is not little tiny stuff. This is stuff that could actually
damage you. Chunks of like car-sized debris.
Yes. And that's a big problem. It's one that we don't want to think about, but as soon as the Wi-Fi goes out, or as soon as we can't see these satellite images of, you know, the park that we're going to visit or something like that, we suddenly realize that there's a problem.
Well, and, you know, with all the plastics, so you're thinking, like, there's obviously a current that pushes a lot of this stuff into the ocean as well in certain areas. I've been considering that maybe, like, one day we'll wake up and, like, Leviathan shows up, and it's like a big plastic bottle.
I'm not going to disagree.
He's taking the form of plastic bottles or something.
How do we go from science fiction to science fact? Yeah. Unfortunately, sometimes.
Might be right there.
That could be it. Because, let's face it. When anytime we look at something, if enough of it exists and enough of it is not being used in a constructive way, it does eventually find an evil purpose. There's just, I mean, that's nature. You know, that's where we talk about the balance. And I hope it's not Leviathan that's plastic, but it could be. It could be. I'm not going to say it won't. We can go a little further back in time, though. I'm always fascinated by the shows. I don't watch them because I tend to laugh at them, but the ghost hunters and go into the spooky house and set up all the equipment and measure stuff, you know, see who's still there. Not that I don't think there are presences, I'm not going to say that, but I just think that the using the technology to try and find it sometimes goes a bit afar. Now, of course, as if we needed to know this, the folks at Frontiers are going to tell us that there's sounds in old houses, and it's not just in old houses. You could be hearing things that are, in fact, there, but that you can't hear consciously. So it's like the undercurrent of noise, and you may be hearing the undercurrent of noise. It's probably not ghosts of a previous century or previous residents of the house, according to this particular study, but it is infrasound, the ultimate ultra-low frequency vibration, which is below our range, but affects us. Our bodies pick it up anyway. So that's what they're going to scare us with that now. Did I hear a noise? Well, maybe you did. I'm glad you heard our noise today. Stick around. We'll be back.
Sammy the Shovel here to tell you to call before you dig.
A lot of homeowners are working hard to create a loving home. Whether it's expanding that crowded deck, maybe a swimming pool, good times start with these additions. And that's why we respectfully ask you to first call 811 and have your utilities properly marked before you dig. It saves you from injury and expense. It's the law, and it's just the right thing to do. So call 811 before you dig. Remember us for your next project. Just call 811.
You smell that? Spring. Hibernation's over. It's time to run it. Run it until the grass becomes long and the hedges duck in cover. Then, run it again. Steel, get up to $50 off select AK battery tool sets. Offer valid for a limited time only at participating dealers while supplies last.
Garden Mama here for all right now. It's the Rockin' Pneumonia and the Boogie Woogie Flu, in case you didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, you are nailing them this morning. Know them all anyway.
They're stuck in my head. Mm-hmm. It's not really a test, thank goodness. I'm talking with Corinne on the text line about rooting a Cuba. And I always hate to disagree with anybody's mama, and I'm happy I could agree with her. She said that it's hard to root it at this time of the year. She's trying to root a piece. And I said, well, if it's real tender new growth and it bends easily, it is going to be harder to root than it will be in a few weeks when it toughens up a little bit. So, yeah, I think your mama's probably right about that one. I like that.
We got a great question from Ray.
What's Ray say?
Ray was like, I know you normally focus on plants and things this morning, though, speaking a little bit about the connection with Earth. What is your opinion or beliefs on grounding sheets? And I've actually read a good bit about those, and I'm curious what you think about those.
Talk about it for a minute.
Well, they're basically sheets that are kind of geared up, sometimes wired with, like, you know, something that allows it to be grounded while you sleep to the floor or to something, you know. So it's supposed to be fairly healthy for you, I guess, because of, you know, the normal electrical outputs that float around and this diffuses some of it or it harnesses in some way. Again, I'm not 100% on what they actually
but it
do.
Is, it's but in the category with weighted blankets.
Sure.
You know, it's all about comfort. And I was listening to somebody talk yesterday about sheets that they swear get cooler every time you wash them. I thought to myself, well, is it just cotton that gets thinner, or is there something else in here? But all of these kinds of comfort mechanisms I find are so individual. I just think that you can't take anybody else's word for it.
Sure. And that, you know, they'll have like silver or copper wound into the
fabric itself. We're trying, it's like when people used to sleep under pyramids. There are people who slept under pyramids, and absolutely the next morning they got up with 1,000 ideas and were able to, you know, write 2 chapters. And there are other people who saw absolutely no difference in their life at all from it. And I realize that it might be more subtle than that, and some people miss it. But I think that whole category is important for us to be aware of, because I don't think we're nearly as in touch as we should be with what's around us.
Well, we have the guy in Russia. What's his name? Alexander Golod.
Yeah.
He had the Russian pyramid for healing, popularized back in the 90s, if I remember.
Yep.
And I've always been fascinated with that one, too, because people say it works miracles.
Yeah. I mean, the people that find good results from things that are a little bit estranged to the other are usually finding a way to connect. And that whole notion of connecting with nature and connecting with yourself to the earth is not a bad thing.
It generates an energy column that alters the physical, the chemical, and the biological processes. Many testimonials out there that I've read and seen that swear by it. And it's one of those things. It's kind of like the hyperbaric chamber almost.
Yes, and that doesn't work for everybody either. Right. But the people it works for, it's a wonderful, wonderful way of treating problems. But for some folks, it doesn't work.
I wonder if you put your plants in something like that. I mean, it's a greenhouse, in essence.
Believe me, there are people the results that I have read personally from that kind of stuff are mixed. And so it probably does go down to the particular plant. It's very much like putting together tests for plants for which ones clean the air better, like they did at the Stennis Space Center so long ago, that gave us the actual list of the best plant cleaners, best air cleaners among plants. And so I'm sure that there's probably a list that will tell you these grew great, these benefited, these got better, and these others over here didn't really matter, didn't make any difference, you know. And that's true of any kind of change that you put your plants through, but I do think that in many cases, the more it is connected to what's around us, the more likely it is to help and to work.
Is there anything with electricity, though, that is beneficial to plants? I mean, you know, we have an electrical world. We think and suggest that talking to your plants or giving them music or certain things does stimulate them or connect them more to what's going on around.
That's the idea.
Is a plant, obviously it's an electrical creation as well. We're all, you know, got electricity in us, but I didn't know.
Because it's all electricity. Yeah. Between magnetism and electricity,
Is there something that you can use, though, like magnets or electrical current that, I know you can do that with water, which will, you know, purify. Is there something you could do there, though, or have you ever read that plants, to get rid of certain diseases or certain things?
There's lots of research that has been done on various things like that. But I do not have a study that I can tell you about that says growing them under a pyramid or doing this will do other things. The reason we study so much about water and sunlight and nutrition is because we know those three things will affect the plant.
That's the ABCs.
And then we get a little further down the road, you know, to growth regulation and the timing of different applications and things. And the more thrifty, the better we can keep the plant growing, the less likely it is to have those pest problems. So as Ray says, the sheets are supposed to provide a path to earth ground for the static charge in your body to be able to dissipate. And that's exactly right. That's the same thing that we would be looking for in the plants, just to be able to clear their pathways. And so that's why I say that if it works, it works.
You know, I've always wondered, you know, with in the South, too, somebody will make a ton of money one day as we get more health conscious with sprays and pesticides and things of that nature. But in small gardens, I've always wondered if there was some type of electrical device or magnets or something that would, say, be tuned in a way to keep the bugs away, you know, kind of create a little force field. Around.
Yeah, there are. There, it's the same principle. There's the things that you plug inside your house that are the sound wave things, but they're just not as good outside.
Okay.
There's all of those, you know, if there's fans that you put outside that basically are draped, and that's what attracts mosquitoes to them, and that's what can slow down them. But the research has shown that you still got to get the mosquitoes to come over there.
Yeah, you got to attract them.
That's a problem because you don't really want to attract anymore.
Hey, we had one question before we go from Brendan in Mendenhall.
Yes.
And it was, the wind and rain caused my tomatoes to blow over. Would I do more damage if I tried to tie them back up?
No, you'd be doing fine. Give it a shot. Because if you do, obviously you don't want to break them, but you need to tie them up just enough so that they are not going to be on the ground when it rains again. That, in turn, exposes them to all of the pathogens that are in the soil that can turn around and rot them. So pick them up if you possibly can. What a lot of things to put up with. We put up with so much stuff in our gardens.
Hey, well, Mike's got a fungi. I've told you about these before. I've seen in the Delta that are just the weirdest thing. The yellow,
beautiful.
Bright yellow.
That's lovely.
Yeah, I've always been curious about those because I'll see them growing up against a tree or at the base of one.
Sure.
They're just the brightest yellow. It stands out. So much in the green.
I don't identify fungi on the air because somebody will hear the wrong thing.
Sure.
But that's beautiful.
Isn't it? I mean, that's so unique.
Just beautiful. I was real happy to see at the farmer's market that I went to last week how many people are growing mushrooms again. We got into that and then we kind of fell out of it a little bit. But I think now that there are so many more people using a different sorts of fungi in their cooking and one thing and another, we're starting to see it pop up again. I think that's great. Gives me great hope for the future.
Well, we don't talk a lot about things, you know, like licorice is one I've read a lot about lately. Licorice root having so many positive digestive and skin qualities to it, and we're starting to see more of the.
We have really, as a society, gone into our guts lately. I should have printed those. I'm still thinking about those T-shirts. So gardening takes guts, you know, because that's one of the things that we have talked about all the time is that your gut really does make a big difference. There's research every week that gives us more details about that, and I'm sure the licorice root is certainly. I mean, that's a powerful substance. There's no reason why it wouldn't make an effect. You're so smart. You brought us all kinds of things today. I'm going to say thank you. I'm going to say thanks to everybody. Thanks to all these beautiful texts. Appreciate hearing from everyone. And thanks again to our friends in Tupelo. We'll be here next week. Looking forward to it.
The Garden Mama Show is a production of SuperTalk Mississippi Media. Download past episodes at supertalk.fm and contact Garden Mama anytime at mamaonair@yahoo.com. Thanks for choosing The Garden Mama Show.
Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.